Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Craig Hamilton of CitizenCraig.com. Ben Stark of Wondermill Films.
Good morning, Craig.
Good morning.
So, we are smack dab in the middle, or I guess, you know, beyond that, in our discussion of the Harry Potter films. And we are up to, I think, kind of the beginning of the closing stretch, in a way. Not just narratively, but also behind the camera. This is the first film, of course, Order of the Phoenix, directed by David Yates, who would direct the rest of the Harry Potter movies and more in terms of the J.K. Rowling universe. This is where I was kind of on a, in 2007, I was kind of on a, I'm not sure, maybe it was the fact that the fourth one kind of didn't hit as hard with me on repeat viewings, or maybe I was just kind of buried. It came out in a very busy summer, this movie, so maybe I was just kind of like paying attention to other things. But I remember not really caring that much that a new Harry Potter movie was coming out, and when I did see it as an obligation in the theater, I wasn't that crazy about it. But on repeat viewing, this movie holds up tremendously well for me, it gets better every time I watch it. Where are you at on, or where were you at when you saw Order of the Phoenix, and where are you at with it now?
Yeah, it was a busy summer, because this was the same, the very last Harry Potter book had come out this summer.
And that's right.
So we were trying to deal with, you know, that, you know, mentally, but then, of course, we had a few extra movies to go. I was there at midnight, addressed as Mad-Eye Moody, and I really liked it. It was much better than the fourth one. And so I think my concern was, I think, you know, okay, a change in director again. You know, this guy's new. He doesn't have as much experience with directing as everybody else had. But I was really pleased with it. It's just the first look. Like I said, the book's really just sort of, the scope blows up during the fourth book. You learn so much about that world that was never mentioned before. And the fifth book, you see the Ministry of Magic for the first time. You hear about it, but you actually see it. And I thought the sets for that and the design for that was pretty great. And so I was cool with the movie. It's probably middle of the pack Harry Potter movie.
Yeah, I mean I think it's again on repeat viewings, it's kind of a cut above. And when I think about, I mean, spoilers, I think for all of these, but I think what always leaves a sour taste in my mouth a little bit in this movie is the death of Sirius Black, which I feel like happens so fast, and which I think is the point of it, but still there's something lost. It's buried in the middle of this big action scene in the Ministry, and then it's followed up by this big, tremendous confrontation between Dumbledore and Voldemort. It's just like you don't even realize the gravity of it in the moment.
That's a really good point. And in the book, imagine, it's supposed to be that way. Imagine a 15-year-old kid whose only role model, mentor, father figure he's ever had, and someone who's he's had very limited communication with, just dies in the middle of the most climactic. It's one of the most climactic scenes in the story, in the series yet, because the idea of Death Eaters are really coming to fruition. You're face-to-face with them, and you're in the middle of the Ministry, of the strangest part of the Ministry of Magic, and you don't know what's going on. And the Order of the Phoenix shows that it's the first real tangible moment where the Order of the Phoenix is trying to do their job, and the Death Eaters are trying to do their job, and his biggest only father figure is gone in the blink of an eye. And the book does a better job of that, because you don't know, you find out who the Death Eaters are because at times their hoods, they don't really have these weird masks. Their hoods just come up because they're actually fighting. And so you kind of see who they are, and the names have been peppered in the last couple of books. And so you say, that was so-and-so that we've heard about that broke out of prison. And then all this kind of really, really cool, like, deep stuff. And then Sirius shows up. And at this point, the whole time you know something bad's going to happen because of the writing of Rowling's tone. And just kind of, you just know something bad's going to happen. It's a very blue, very depressing book. It's all very sort of just like, I don't want to say emo because it's not emo. It's anger. It's 15-year-old anger and angst.
Yeah.
And Sirius is there. Sirius shouldn't be there. And the book does a good job of saying all this. And I think the movie does a decent job too. But he's supposed to be in hiding because people think he's bad. And he's out to say he's only out for Harry. That's why Harry was brought there, because they knew Sirius Black was his weak spot. And he's there, and he's awesome, and he dies, and Harry can't process it. He runs after Bellatrix, who kills him, and Bellatrix leads him out to the atrium of the Ministry, where Voldemort shows up. And it's just this bam, bam, bam. You knew something bad was going to happen. The reader can't process it, because it's in a moment where you have to continue reading. You have to finish this.
Right.
And you can't sit there and let that, you know, and either you go back and read it, or you lose the essence of that moment if you stop and cry, which a lot of people did. Not me. No.
Well, here's one thing that I feel like softens it a little bit is he gets zapped and then he falls into a doorway and like disappears.
Yeah.
Like what is that? Why doesn't he just evaporate or die?
This is probably one of the biggest faux pas of the movies as far as not going along with the books. So that archway, it's a mysterious thing that Rowling only really gives more information about once all the books have been released. It's sort of an archway. It's sort of a dais in the middle of this little, you know, mini coliseum. And on the other side of it, I believe it's death. You go to the other side, you can't come back from it. But it literally, on the other side of that veil, you know, there's been allusions to the veil that was split when Christ was crucified. That's just sort of maybe just allusion to that, not really the exact thing, obviously, but there's just sort of a connection there, literally.
Yeah,
is that a word? So that's, you don't even know, that's the thing, you don't know what that is until way later, and he falls through it. The thing is, here's the big problem with the movie, is that, you know, the Avada Kedavra curse, it kills you, right?
Right.
Like, it kills you where you stand.
Right.
Like, you get hit with that, you fall straight down to the ground, and you stop moving and breathing, you stop living, your soul stops being inside your body. Right? That's how death works. But what happened is that in the book is that he got hit with like a stunning spell and
right.
blew him backwards into the, like, he's fighting around that veil and he's like, and he's doing a great job, but you're reading it and you're like, no, move from that area.
Yeah.
And his cousin, Bellatrix Lestrange, it supervised him through that veil.
Right.
And Harry does not know what that veil is. So he's about to go run through it to get it, and they're all holding him back. He's like, wait, what are you talking about? And they're like, no, he's gone. He's like, how could it be gone? I don't even, you know? They're like, and then, well, actually, Harry, this is the veil that studies the death and where you go and how to...
Yeah, you can't stop.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, and he didn't know that. But the thing of the movie is he gets hit with an Avada Kedavra curse, stands there, looks down at it, looks up, and shuffles backwards into the archway.
Yeah, he's just kind of moonwalks into it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a real bad. That's real bad that the movie did that.
Yeah. See, that's. I feel like that was the major sticking point for me coming out of the movie, and why I just kind of like wrote off the movie when I first saw it, which is, you know, not the right way to process it at all. But I think now, even now that I like the rest of the movie, it still stands I guess justifiably is a bit of an odd spot there. One thing that I do love about the movie is David Yates, and I remember the first time I watched it, I was so skeptical because, you know, I was like, well, obviously, you know, I'm not a fan of Chris Columbus, but then Alfonso Cuarón, I loved his entry and I loved his filmography, and then I was disappointed that he wasn't coming back. And then Mike Newell, I think, has made some fine films, but I really liked his movie, and I was like, well, you know, it could have been better, but just stick with somebody, and he didn't come back. And you read all, I remember around that time you reading all these things that they were asking all these people to direct the film, and it was like Mira Nair, I believe, was on the list. I think Tim Burton was on the list at some point, which would have been atrocious. Like all these names, and then they ended up landing on this British TV director, David Yates. And I remember thinking, well, that's a big disappointment. I want an auteur. You know, I don't want some guy that the studio can push around. And then I watched the movie, and early on, within the first kind of opening sequence, there's this wide-angle close-up of him, and it's just a really striking composition, the way that it's designed and everything. And I was like, oh, okay, hold on. There's something special about this guy's eye. And then the rest of the movie, all the designs, I think it's one of the, so far, one of the cleaner, more cleanly designed Harry Potter movies. I think the way he shoots is really interesting. I think every single shot in these David Yates movies is interesting or fun in some way or another. And you can tell he is pushing himself to, you know, give this universe a dose of reality, but never forget about the fancifulness going on. And in all his movies, I feel like he maintains that. I mean, all of his movies are darker, you know, again, because it's in the second half of the franchise, but he maintains this charm and this character dynamic between all the actors that I feel like, especially as they grew older, was really strong. He ends up being probably my favorite director in terms of this series, and this is where it all starts. How did his work strike you when you first saw it?
Yeah, it was clean. I think clean is a good word. You know, and being another directing change, what you really want to see is consistency, and you can't see consistency in one movie when you're talking about a series.
Sure.
So it was still really I was really pleased with that, him being a first director. I love the way they showed, as I said, the Ministry of Magic, and that whole thing was really, it took what my mental image of it was taken in a different direction, as always, and it's always better. And I think what you mentioned about the swing set scene, I was the same way. When I saw that scene, I was like, I'm not worried anymore, because even though the rest of the movie was nothing like that, that's okay. He's in a different world here in the real world. He's not in his world, but that was an incredible scene. And then them running to that underpass. Mm-hmm. That right there was, I think I might have seen that. I can't remember if I saw it in the trailer or if the first time I saw that was in the movie. But I was like, yeah, if the guy that can shoot stuff like this dares to do that for this movie, even for a little bit, then I know he can do some pretty great stuff, just because he's trying to do something different, and it looks really cool, and it's really grainy. Does that word make you mad?
A little bit, but no, go ahead.
But it did look like an indie film.
He knows when to take the polish off, and he knows when to leave it on. You know, he knows when to make things look majestic and grand and smooth, but then he knows when to make things chaotic. And I mean, just last night we were watching Deathly Hallows Part One, and there's that awesome chase through the woods with the collector guys. And it's so hectic, and so, I mean, no single shot lasts more than a few frames, and that's awesome. But obviously, you can't do that for the whole movie. And David Yates knows when to, you know, click on that type of film grammar, and when to back off, and then let the, you know, do it all in one long take. And he does that too. And he's just a he's a very he's just a great craftsman, I think. And I've always wanted to go and look at some of his British TV. I know he did the original State of Play, and he did, I think he did a movie about sex trafficking or something like that, maybe. So he definitely came from
ready.
A... Huh?
Get your popcorn ready.
Yes. Yeah, he definitely came from a different world, but I feel like that's an interesting interesting approach, and I feel like he's definitely J.K. Rowling's favorite. You know, I think that after she saw this movie, for whatever reason, I think that she... They found themselves to be kindred spirits in a way, because he has not left the franchise since then. And you have to wonder if something like Fantastic Beasts would have happened if he hadn't agreed to at least kick it off.
Interesting. That's an interesting point, yeah. Or if that may have been in... Yeah, you know, she was definitely going to write afterwards, but who knows if it would have been in the form of one of her charitable one-off books from, you know, that she knew he could have made into a great movie. So that's a good point, yeah. We may not have had that whole series at all. Imelda Staunton.
Yes.
Talk about, I think she, man, she comes so close as you can to perfectly playing a character from a book. I mean, as good as anybody else in the series.
She's great. I mean,
the whole.
I think one reason I like this movie more and more, strangely enough, as I become older, the whole, there's like a, obviously it's kind of silly to say punk rock in terms of a, you know, multi-million-dollar studio franchise movie, but there is a punk rock element to this. You know, this is the part of the adolescent years, you know, where the kids discover Operation Ivy and Rage Against the Machine. You know, this is the part where they realize that the establishment does not have their best interests at heart. And I love that. And I love that part of the adolescence that they're bringing out, and also that thing about this movie. And I feel like it's, I don't know, nowadays I'm responding to those things more again, as I did when I was a teenager, and that's just something that's really, it's a great part of adolescence, and it's a great movie about that, you know, about this, well, we don't like the way that, you know, that things are being run, and we're not going to just sit and do nothing. I mean, we're not going to, you know, go kill anybody, but also we're going to resist in the right ways. And, you know, I'm a fan of resistance movies like Army of Shadows and stuff like that, and I feel like this kind of goes in that direction. It's a really badass direction to go, I guess, is the crass way for me to say it.
And there's this idea in the book that Sirius Black tells Harry, in this book actually, is that there's a different Harry's got this idea that anybody that's bad is a Death Eater or on their side, and Sirius has to remind him there's a difference. You know, you can't split the whole world into good guys and Death Eaters. There are Death Eaters and there are good guys and there are people in between.
Yeah.
And while the Minister of Magic is not, he's a horrible minister. He's not the best one. He's not exactly a follower of Voldemort. He's a denier, but,
right.
but he has people at Hogwarts now that are, you know, no spoilers, but are really, really close to, you know, being that, and that's something else that the reader too, and the viewer is, you know, there are people that they may not be horrible people, they may not be great people, but they're not Death Eaters just because they're not good. So there's something else you have to deal with. They're unhelpful, mean adults that are not good and not necessarily bad that you still have to deal with, and that's what the Dumbledore's army is that. Because no one is believing anybody, these kids have to take it upon themselves to arm themselves and to learn how to defend themselves. So, but there's one thing about how they get busted. They get caught practicing that secret room.
Sure.
Which also, that's the same room that catches on fire at the end of Deathly Hallows. But we can talk about that then.
Okay.
It's the room of requirement. So whatever you need, it has.
Wait. there, that's the rumor. But in the next movie, the rumor requirement has a bunch of crap in it.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's either Dumbledore mentions it briefly in one of the books, but Harry finds Harry comes across a room when he's trying to hide something, and this door in the wall opens up and he hides there, something like that. And that's the room of requirement. You only find it if you need something or you need to get rid of something. And so, I mean, only a select few people have ever found it. And there's another student that had found it and calls it the room of needed things or something like that. And you find it for your own purposes, so you may see a different room. So,
of course, okay.
Harry says, I need a place to practice. He goes into it knowing that. He says, I need a place to practice. Oh, it was Neville. Neville actually had the idea.
Right.
And so, yeah. And so they say, yeah, we need a place to practice. And it gives them all these things they need. And so later when he needs to hide that book in the next movie, he's like, I need a place to hide this book. And it appears. And he's like, oh. And that's all room where students have needed to hide things for centuries, probably.
I can see the continuity issues on how to visualize that, but I no connection to that.
Yeah, they don't really bring it up because it's really not pertinent. But.
Right.
But yeah,
well, so, I think it is. But anyway, go ahead.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely a cool connection. But, you know, they get busted because Cho Chang, there's a difference in the book than the movie, and it sort of makes it look like Cho tells on him.
Yeah.
And even though she's given the truth potion, they're still kind of mad at her.
Yeah.
But in the book, it's Cho's friend that never really wanted to be there. And they see her the next day after she had ratted him out, and she's got like this, like, these like zits all over her forehead that spell out like rat, I don't know, something like, you know, you squealed on us.
Yeah.
And Hermione had put that jinx on everybody that whoever told on them was going to get that busted all over their forehead. So, and that was in the movie, they decided to show it, make Cho look like a rat instead. But anyways.
Well, but I think they clear. I like that change, actually. I think that makes it a little bit, that makes you have to not introduce that side character, and it creates that tension between her and him, and it eventually proves her innocence, but it doesn't change the fact that he held it against her and it kind of killed the relationship.
So. Yeah, and that's the only thing is that it does show that she didn't, that it wasn't really her fault, but there's nothing done on the other guy's side to say, oh, it's our bad. Yeah, we get it. It's not your fault.
Yeah.
It's just like, yeah, you suck. You still suck. You suck just as much as it was your fault.
Well, awesome. Well, I think, like I said, this is we'll do our rankings probably when we're all done. But this one gets better with time. We didn't get a chance to talk about Hagrid's brother, which I think is another kind of issue with the movie. But maybe just from it kind of comes out of nowhere. The effects aren't great, and then kind of never comes up again, if I recall. But
that's something they definitely could have left out. In the book, Hagrid is constantly beat up, and you see Hagrid a lot, and he's definitely hiding something. And in the book, I'm trying to think of what the purpose is for the book, too. It's just something else they have to deal with.
Yeah.
Some of the responsibility that is heaped upon their shoulders that they don't need nor should be asked to do.
Yeah. He just starves to death whenever they leave civilization in Deathly Hallows, right? Because
they
were supposed to take care of him, and then they just left.
I was like, well, we're supposed to do something.
Yeah, isn't there something like we're supposed
later.
To feed? I kind of think about it now that, you know, why not just bring back the centaurs earlier in the movie? You know, you already set those up in the first movie. So, revisit that at the beginning of this, and then have that be the thing that Hermione beats Umbridge out there to get, you know, tackled by.
That's the thing. So, in the book, there's a lone centaur that helps Harry and Dumbledore, is friendly with Dumbledore, that the centaurs kick out, and Dumbledore hires him to teach divination.
Huh.
There's a centaur teacher for a short period of time.
Oh, that could be bad.
Yeah, so that's really, they kind of had to just forget about the centaurs. But you could have easily, as you said, just showed them in the beginning somehow. Or maybe showed that there's tension.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, to show that something's out there in the woods and that they're scared of it. And then Hermione thinks,
well, this could kill us, or it could get us out of this thing, and then leads her out there. Yep, I just improved the movie.
I've done that with Frozen many times.
You have on this podcast. I guess one thing to note before we close out, it is a different screenwriter. I think it's the only screenwriter, only script not written by Steve Kloves. This is when it's like, yeah, Michael Goldenberg or something. So I wonder if a few of these things are just, you know, kind of a first, you know,
yeah,
just the problem with a guy that's kind of coming in, having to cram all this stuff out in without having experience,
yeah,
with the other ones and kind of an idea of where it's going.
And I know there's a story there. I can never, it's never been given in great detail, but there is something there. Like, why the one movie drop off? Maybe it's because it's the first time, new director or something, but they immediately all come back and it all works well. So.
Yeah. I mean, I think Kloves was, the thing I saw is that he was just busy and exhausted. And I mean, I don't blame him necessarily. He'd been kind of shepherding this for many years. So, but at the same time, yeah, I think this was definitely a transition point in the series. And, you know, had this not stuck the landing, it could have been really concerning, and it totally,
yeah,
did. So I think we're in good hands from here on out, and I look forward to talking to you about Half-Blood Prince.
Oh, same here. It's a great one.
For more Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.